Let me begin by reiterating the thanks to Elisa and to John for organizing the event, for the kind invitation to give a talk here. For me in particular, it's always a great pleasure to come home, because this is the department from which I took my PhD back in 1979, and it's a delight to see old friends and old teachers like Bob and John here in the audience. And if I might also, now that I've been at Notre Dame and associated with the HPS program for a long run, it's also really nice to come back here to Boston and find philosophy of science at BU in the good hands of Elisa Bokolich, and to find philosophy of science at the other end of Commonwealth Avenue at Boston College in the good hands of two of our other students, namely Dan McCoyne and Holly Vandewall. Notre Dame HPS owns philosophy of science here in Boston, and we're very, very proud of it, at least on this side of the world, right, which is the side that counts it. Anyway, my topic today is going to be Einstein and the development of 20th century philosophy of science. I want to persuade you by the end of this talk of the following three claims. First of all, that general relativity was the major engine driving the development of core right-wing logical empiricism in the 1910s and 1920s, and Neo-Kantian philosophy of science of the same period. And what I mean here by core right-wing logical empiricism is the philosophy of science, the project as we associate it with thinkers like Reichenbach and Schlick and Carnap. But I also want to persuade you that Einstein's own philosophy of science was considerably more sophisticated, interesting, and important than many of the standard narratives would lead us to believe. And thirdly, I want to persuade you of the claim that Einstein himself was not just a bystander, not just a kibitzer, that Einstein himself, through his own writings and through his own incredibly extensive connections, correspondences, conversations with all of the major figures in the development of early 20th century philosophy of science, that Einstein was himself one of the most important thinkers elaborating this project in the early 20th century. Let's turn right to the task. And let's start here with a few points about Einstein's early acquaintance with philosophy. Because part of what's extraordinary about Einstein is that even by the standards of his day, he was uncommonly well-read in the works of all of the most important historians and philosophers of science of his generation. Already by the time he was a high school student, he had, for example, read all three critiques of Kant and read them thoroughly. These three little volumes, by the way, are still in his library, which you can palpate them in Jerusalem if you want to go hold the very editions that he read. More to the point is what we know about his continuing exposure to history and philosophy of science while he was a student at the ETH from 1896 to 1900. So, for example, we know that during these years he read Mach's two great critical historical works, the work on the history of mechanics and the book on the history of the principles of the theory of heat. He read much more widely than just technical history of physics and philosophy of science, however. We know for a fact that he was reading Schopenhauer by this period, and we know specifically that he was reading Parerga and Paralipomena at this time. It's also important to note coursework during his time at the ETH that is directly relevant to his exposure to this content. So in the summer semester of 1897, he took under the direction of August Stadler, it was a neo-Kantian, a very prominent neo-Kantian. He had been the first PhD student of Hermann Cohen in Marburg. That was a very important figure in the Marburg tradition. Einstein had taken Stadler's lectures on the philosophy of Kant. And even more interesting, in the winter semester of 1897, he took with Stadler his lecture course on the Theorie des Wissenschaftlichen Denkens, the theory of scientific thought, which is the lecture notes surviving, go read them in Zurich. It was a pure course in the philosophy of science. And I've always been especially impressed by the fact that on the transcript and in the catalog, you will see this course noted as an obligatorisches Fach, an obligatory subject. This course was required of every physics student at the ETH during those years. And that tells us a lot about how different physics education at that time was, at least at the ETH, from what it's like today. We also have strong evidence for Einstein's having read still many other works during this period. Of special importance to me are his probably having read at this time Friedrich Albert Lange's History of Materialism, Eugen Döring's Critical History of the Principles of Mechanics. I'm especially fascinated by this book that's in his library, Ferdinand Rosenberger's Isaac Newton and His Physical Principles. The question arose earlier this morning about the nature of Einstein's exposure to Newton. I'm convinced that it was mainly this book through which the young Einstein knew his Newton. And it's a tragedy that this book has fallen out of the canon because it is a spectacular book. It deserves to be put into English at some point. It deserves to be brought back into the history and philosophy of science mainstream. I urge you to take a look at the book. We know even more about Einstein's continuing education in the history and philosophy of science during his time in Bern, and especially in the context of the so-called Olympia Academy, this weekly evening reading and discussion group that Einstein and several friends formed. And thanks to the later recollections of Maurice Solovine, we have the reading list for the Olympia Academy. And among the titles, the many titles on the reading list, are Avenarius's Critique of Pure Experience, Avenarius being the most important positivist of that generation, alongside Mach, Dedekind's Was sind, was sollen die Zahlen. They read Hume, they read Mach's analysis of sensations and analyse der Empfindungen. They read Mill, they read Carl Pearson's Grammar of Science, and very importantly, they read Poincaré's La Science et l'Hypothèse, probably in the 1904 German translation of that work. So the one point to start with is that Einstein, by the time he reaches intellectual maturity, is extraordinarily well educated in all the best history and philosophy of science of his era. Well, let's now start to dig a little bit more deeply and to talk about the influence of this exposure on the formation of Einstein's own philosophy of science. And let's start with the character of Mach, because if you've heard any narrative about Einstein's philosophy of science, it may well be the old standard narrative that, at least in his early years, if not lifelong, Einstein was some kind of Machian positivist. I don't want to spend too long talking about this, but I want to say dogmatically, Einstein was probably never an orthodox Machian positivist. What's more, Ernst Mach was never an orthodox Machian positivist. And in Q&A, I'd love to have a conversation about how I grow ever more convinced of the errors in our traditional reading of Mach's own project. But let's take it from Einstein himself. His most clear recollection of the exact nature of Mach's influence on him, and it's quite surprising because it wasn't some kind of reductionist phenomenalism that he supposedly learned from the analysis of sensations. No, what Einstein extols in this 1916 obituary for Mach in the Physikalische Zeitschrift was, in fact, specifically the historical critical writings of Mach. Fact is that Mach exercised a great influence upon our generation through his historical critical writings. We could go a little bit more deeper into the fine structure of what it was that he learned from Mach. It's basically simply the idea that we historicize these intellectual achievements for the purpose of understanding how it could be that they did important physical scientific work in a given historical and problematic context, but how when the context changes, the good work they once did maybe is no longer being done. It's a kind of a subversive historicist critical reading of the tradition. As mentioned, another figure. But so first of all, just so here's Mach. Think of Mach broadly as an empiricist. Think about Einstein having had his own deep commitments to empiricism, strongly reinforced by his exposure to Mach. He also read Poincaré at around this time. We know, for example, that he read Science and Hypothesis. And of course, one of the things that he read in Science and Hypothesis is the famous essay on experiment and geometry, which is the classic source for what we term Poincaré's geometrical conventionalism. And just to keep this clear in our mind, let's remember this as the idea that at least for a metrical geometry, such a theory acquires empirical content only through conventional definitions, as with the definition of straight line segment as a segment of a path of a ray of light, where you are linking a geometrical primitive to a physical or an experiential primitive. And very importantly, in Poincaré's version of conventionalism, these conventional definitions, later on we will learn to call them coordinating definitions, but that wasn't the term in 1904. Very important is that these conventional definitions are determined systematically from contentful empirical assertions, such as the ascription of a metrical structure to space. And the idea that they can and should be so distinguished is a very important feature of the Poincaré version of conventionalism. Now, a figure whom we haven't talked about so far, because Einstein's exposure came a few years later, but someone whose influence on Einstein was, I have long been convinced, profound and enduring, is the other great French conventionalist of the early 20th century, the physical chemist, historian of science, and philosopher of science, Pierre Duhem, whose major philosophical work was published in 1906 in France, La théorie physique, son objet et sa structure, and then it appeared in a German translation in 1908 under the title Ziel und Struktur der physikalischen Theorien, with a foreword by Ernst Mach and translated by a person named Friedrich Adler. Again, I could go off and spend a whole hour talking about the fascinating story of Einstein's exposure to Duhem, but the character of Adler is very, very interesting. He had been Einstein's friend and fellow physics student in Zurich, 1896 to 1900, except that Adler was a student at the University of Zurich, not at the ETH. Adler had also been the other finalist for the chair in physics at the University of Zurich that Einstein occupies in 1909 when he ends his career in Bern. Adler also happens to have been the son of Victor Adler, one of the co-founders of the Austrian Social Democratic Party, and Adler became infamous when in 1916 he assassinated the Austrian minister-president Count Stuck as a gesture of protest against Austrian war policies. The connection between Einstein and Adler is really interesting because, as it happens, when Einstein moved back to Bern in 1909, quite by accident, they rented a flat upstairs from the Adler household, and they resumed their once close relationship. We have these wonderful letters from Adler back to his father describing how he and Einstein set up a joint study for themselves in the attic of the apartment house, up in the attic so as to be as far away as possible from the noise of the children playing in the courtyard. And he records at great length the extensive conversations that he and Einstein had during this period. And mind you, this is 1 year after the publication of Adler's translation of Duhem's aim and structure of physical theory. There is no smoking gun in the form of Einstein recording in a letter or in a diary, "Today I sat down and I read cover to cover Duhem's wonderful book." There is no evidence of that kind. But there is compelling evidence that Einstein read and thoroughly absorbed the chief epistemological insight of Duhem's book. And let me explain to you what that is, because again, I want to keep tracking this as we go forward. So the most important difference between Duhem's version of conventionalism, for our purposes here today, and Poincaré's version of conventionalism is that whereas Poincaré insisted on a systematic and principled difference in kind between analytic coordinating definitions and synthetic, empirical, contentful scientific propositions, Duhem famously defended a kind of theory holism. It's a progenitor of the doctrine we later know quite well through the work of Quine. He defends a principled theory holism within which it is impossible to make that kind of systematic principled distinction between analytic propositions analytic coordinating definitions, and synthetic empirical propositions. Instead, for Duhem, theory is always has content, empirical content, only as a whole body of theory, and theory is therefore tested only as a whole body of theory. And it's from that holism that there derives then the famous Duhemian thesis about the underdetermination of theory choice by empirical evidence, because theory being testable only as a whole, if there emerges some lack of fit between theory and experience, there will always in principle be a multiplicity of different ways of making adjustments within that total body of theory to restore the fit with experience. That Einstein absorbed the chief epistemological legacy of Duhem is made crystal clear by these two paragraphs from Einstein's own lecture notes for his electricity and magnetism lectures in Zurich in the winter semester of 1910-1911. I won't read the whole passage here. You can at your leisure. Basically, what's happening at this point in the lectures is he's talking with his students about the idea of a solid extended material body with a charge density defined throughout the body. So think about early attempts to try to model the structure of the electron, if you will. And he poses for them a kind of Machian or simple-minded Machian question, and that is, does this idea of there being a well-defined charge density in the interior of a solid charged body make any sense at all, since, after all, you can't even in imagination think about introducing a test body within the interior to measure the reaction of that body to the field generated by the local element of charge. And so the worry is that if you're some simple-minded Machian, which Mach himself wasn't even really, then you couldn't, there would be no empirical content in this idea. And what Einstein says at this point is precisely the Duhemian point. He says, well, but there's no worry here, because of course we all know that we test our theories only as wholes. And so if this postulation of charge density inside the solid body is part of a larger and coherent theory that as a whole has empirical content, then it's a perfectly respectable scientific notion. Let me not go on here at too great a length about the following. I don't want to read these quotations, but I want to make one very important philosophical point, and that is, on the point of this, what I've constructed as the chief difference between Poincaré and Duhem, that Poincaré insists on a systematic principle difference between analytic coordinating definitions and contentful synthetic empirical claims, and that Duhem, on the other hand, directly denies the cogency of any such distinction, the possibility of any such distinction. That is crystal clear in the latter sections of The Aim and Structure of Physical Theory. Duhem devotes two entire sections at the in the penultimate chapter to precisely this question. Poincaré is named as the target of the argument, and he explicitly denies that there's any principled systematic way to separate off a coordinating definition from an empirical claim. He does this with reference to several examples, such as putative empirical tests of the law of free fall, and so on and so forth. So this is a well-known point. It was well-known to anybody reading this stuff at the time, and it's actually quite crucial. So let's skip over that. And let me move on then to talk about another figure, someone who is not ordinarily a part of the philosophical canon in the early 20th century, but who very much should be, and who was very much an important player at the time. And that is the physicist Philipp Frank, who was Einstein's successor in the physics chair at the Charles University in Prague when Einstein, in 1912, moved back to the ETH, before later moving on to Berlin. Einstein himself had recommended Frank for this position, and in his letter of recommendation, Einstein singles out not only Mach's own or Frank's own early important contributions of the mathematical physics of special relativity, but he also singles out Frank's unusual sophistication about an engagement with philosophy of science topics. Frank later went on to write extensively on many topics in the philosophy of science, in particular about the principle of causality. He also became Einstein's first really serious biographer and is quite an impressive philosopher of science in his own right. And it's extremely important that Frank's own philosophy of science is very much in the Duhemian tradition. OK, Okay? Shorthand version of Franck's philosophy of science is it's Duhem's theory holism and underdeterminationism. But with a twist. Let's skip this. This is a recollection where Franck recalls his first encounter by letter with Einstein. But interestingly, it recalls that the very first encounter in 1907, after he published his first paper on the principle of causality, that the very first letter from Einstein wanted to take up a philosophy of science question about the argument that Franck was making there. And it all has to do with the role of convention and the role of simplicity as a criterion of theory choice and the question of how much objectivity there is in judgments of simplicity. So, I mean, there's already a lot of focus upon and sophistication about the philosophy of science issues in their very earliest acquaintance. But I want to dwell a moment on a point that Franck then goes on to make repeatedly in later years about the central philosophical problematic involving Mach, Poincaré, Duhem, and Einstein. And again, I won't bore you by reading through some of these really very interesting remarks. Let me just, in a very brief shorthand way, characterize what is the essential point here. The young Franck was enormously impressed by Mach's philosophy of science, and he was equally impressed by Poincaré's philosophy of science, and he rightly sensed a philosophical tension between, let's call it, the empiricist foundationalism of Mach's project and the conventionalism of Poincaré. And he was eager to try to find a way to reconcile these two points of view. Our theories always have to be put to an empirical test, but there's this extraordinary free play in the way in which we connect theory with experiment according to Poincaré. The point that Franck made again and again and again was that the key to resolving that tension was provided specifically by Duhem's epistemological and theory holism. So his way of telling the history of the early 20th century is you've got Mach, you've got Poincaré, there's a tension between them, but once we learn the lesson of Duhem's rather different form of conventionalism, we see how to put empiricism and conventionalism together in one consistent philosophical picture about the structure and empirical interpretation of scientific theories. So for him, Duhem reconciles Mach and Poincaré. And, very importantly, he says time and time and time again, this was exactly the move Einstein was making as well. To use the theory holism of Duhem to function as the needed mediator between the empiricist foundationalism of Mach and the conventionalism of Poincaré, exactly after the model of Duhem. Now, to many of us, and especially when I was a young guy and first started reading this stuff, I found this strikingly problematic. Why? Because coming to philosophical maturity in the age of Quine, and having cut my philosophical teeth on two dogmas of empiricism, you may remember that one of the dogmas of empiricism is the analytic-synthetic distinction, and Duhem's holism, named explicitly by Quine, is supposed to be the antidote to that. And the other dogma is reductionist empiricism, and he says these are two sides of the same philosophical coin, and he sees Duhem's holism as directly antithetical to the reductionist phenomenalism that is said to be core to Mach's philosophical project. So years ago, we were all taught to see the philosophies of science of Mach and Duhem as being diametrically opposed to one another, meaning that this story that Franck tells about Duhem as the mediator between Mach and Poincaré to us didn't make a lot of sense. Until, that is, I started digging a little bit more deeply into the Mach and Duhem connection. And let me fast forward here to this remark, which again I won't read in its entirety, but I'll make this this point. Think about the chronology. Aim and Structure of Physical Theory is published in the French edition in 1906. It appears in a German translation in 1908 by Friedrich Adler, but bearing a preface by none other than Ernst Mach, who, as it turns out, is the person who championed the production of the German translation and its publication by Springer. Also in 1906, immediately after the appearance of Duhem's Aim and Structure of Physical Theory, which, by the way, had been serialized a year earlier still in a French philosophy, a French Catholic philosophy journal, in 1906, Mach issues a second edition of his last great book, that is, Erkenntnis und Irrtum, Knowledge and Error. And you ask, why a second edition 1 year after the first edition? Was it that big a hit in the bookstores? And you compare the two, and you see that they are virtually identical to one another, except for this one systematic difference, which is that at various places in the second edition, you see the addition of text and footnotes that are there for the purpose of Mach himself, in his own words, recording his own profound agreement with exactly those features of Duhem's project, his theory holism, his denial of a principal distinction between coordinating definitions and empirical content, his underdetermination. Mach records here his deep agreement with each one of those features of Duhem's project that we were taught was directly contradictory to Mach's project. Well, as you can see, that's part of my evidence for the claim that Mach was never a Machian positivist. So bear that in mind. Let's jump to, let me skip over that. Let's jump then ahead a few years to Einstein's early acquaintance with Moritz Schlick, who is, of course, one of the most important figures in the development of the logical empiricist project in the 20th century. Someone who wrote widely and often on questions in the philosophy of science, philosophy of physics. I want to say a little bit more in detail about several of his early works, but note that in 1915 he publishes his first paper on the philosophical significance of the relativity principle. In 1917 he publishes his enormously successful, went through four editions and an English translation, his extraordinarily successful and impactful book, Space and Time in Contemporary Physics. In 1921, he publishes an extremely important essay that I'll come back to in a moment, Critical or Empiricist Interpretation of Modern Physics, and so on, and so forth. Einstein received from Schlick in the winter of 1915 a preprint of his paper on the philosophical significance of the relativity principle. He read it, he loved it. He wrote back to Schlick this fan letter. I want to come back to the quotation. He said, yesterday I received your essay, already studied it through completely. It's among the best that have now been written about relativity theory. From the philosophical side, nothing at all appears to have been written on the subject that is nearly so clear. At the same time, you really have complete command of the subject. There's nothing in your exposition with which I find fault. Total, thoroughgoing, complete, unreserved agreement with what Schlick is arguing. Well, what was he arguing? Well, there are many things he was talking about in this essay, but for the purposes of our discussion today, this is what's crucially important. And that is, again, I won't read the whole quotation, you can read it yourself. What Einstein found, among many other things, in this essay was a very different kind of theory holism and underdeterminationism that Schlick had been developing during those years, not deriving from Duhem's premises, but instead deriving from a highly original and in those years extraordinarily influential paper that Schlick himself had published 5 years earlier called The Essence of Truth According to Modern Logic, in which Schlick proposed this sort of unusual conception, definition of truth as one way univocal coordination, and nothing more. It's this deliberately very lean, mean theory of truth. One-way univocal coordination between theory on the one hand and world on the other hand, or proposition on the one hand and empirical content, fact, whatever, on the other hand. The one-way univocal coordination going in the direction from proposition to world. So to one given body of theory, there corresponds a unique a set of physical circumstances. To one proposition, there corresponds a unique body of fact. But very important for Schlick, and here's the underdeterminationism, for Schlick, the coordination is not univocal in the other direction. For Schlick, it was crucially important that in the direction from world or experience on the one hand, proposition theory on the other hand, the coordination was not univocal. And he says in this essay and in many other of his writings during this period, that it's in the nature of the case, it's a direct implication of this way of thinking about truth, that there will always be a multiplicity of different theories equally well univocally coordinated with the same body of fact. So Einstein reads this stuff and he finds strong reinforcement for a picture about the structure and empirical interpretation of scientific theories that's broadly Duhemian, but derived from importantly different philosophical premises. That was 1915. As mentioned in 1917, Schlick publishes this monograph, Space and Time in Contemporary Physics, and he there, and by the way, I should add that Schlick explains in the introduction to this monograph that the whole purpose of this exercise is to spell out the philosophical foundations and implications of Einstein's oft-repeated assertion that the lesson of general covariance, once we've got general relativity in its proper form, 1915, that the lesson of general covariance is that space and time thereby lose the last vestige of physical reality. So that's very important, that this monograph is meant as an explication of that philosophical gloss that Einstein himself had put on the development of the general theory of relativity. And in this monograph, we find Schlick once again rehearsing this very same argument from truth as one-way univocality to underdetermination in theory choice. And once again, Einstein is hugely enthusiastic. Again and again, I take a look at your little book and am delighted by the splendidly clear expositions, and the last section, Relations to Philosophy, appears to me to be excellent. Now, I've got a moment. Let me take a slight... Actually, no, I'm going to skip over this just for the sake of time. I want to get on to some other stuff. Some very interesting stuff there about the reality concept, but we can perhaps come back to that later on. Let's move ahead to the later teens in the early 1920s. This is going to take us back to Kant, which is a pun, by the way, for any funny literate in the Marburg Neo-Kantian. And remind ourselves about Einstein's own early and extensive exposure to the work of Kant. In the late teens, loosely in conjunction with the beginning of what becomes a flood of books and papers from neo-Kantians associated both with the Marburg critical idealist tradition and also the Berlin critical realist school around Alois Riehl, there begins to be this flood of papers and books on general relativity and Kant. I won't go into the fine structure of all the different varieties of neo-Kantian reactions to general relativity there and the main critical, with one or two notable exceptions that I'll speak about in a moment. But around this time, Einstein himself goes back to reading Kant and rethinking his attitude toward Kant. And so, among other things, we have this lovely note that he writes to Born in July of 1918, where he says, I'm reading Kant's Prolegomena here, among other things, and beginning to comprehend the enormous suggestive power that emanated from the fellow and still does, once you concede to him merely the existence of synthetic a priori judgments. You're trapped. I have to water down the a priori to conventional so as not to have to contradict him, but even then the details do not quite fit. Anyway, it is very nice to read, even if it is not as good as his predecessor Hume's work. Hume also had a far sounder instinct. Or, a year later, this from the memoir that Ilse Rosenthal Schneider, who had been a student of Alois Riehl's in Berlin in these years, and who had a series of meetings with Einstein during this period to talk about these very topics, wrote this lovely memoir about this many, many years later. One of the many gems in here, she quotes Einstein's remark from 15 September 1919. I have received the mentioned dissertation. I guess this is his letter to her, not from her memoir. He says, I have received the mentioned dissertation by S. This is Uwald Zalian, who's yet another student of Alois Riehl's. It's his book, Epistemology and Relativity Theory, or he gets the title wrong. this module's significance of theory of relativity. And he writes, Kant's celebrated view on time reminds me of Anderson's tale about the emperor's new clothes, except that instead of the emperor's clothes, it concerns the form of intuition. So he's rethinking Kant, and of course he's highly critical of the Kantian notion of the a priori. But of course, one of the two most sophisticated and important neo-Kantians thinking about the philosophy of general relativity of this time is Ernst Cassirer, whose book on Einstein's theory of relativity appeared in 1921. I should note that as with Schlick, with whom Einstein had a long and close personal professional acquaintance, as with Reichenbach, whom we'll turn to in a moment, where there was a long and close professional personal acquaintance, so too Einstein knew Cassirer, especially during the war years, especially Berlin in the teens, when Cassirer had completed his dissertation at Marburg, and he and Einstein were part of this sort of left liberal, culturally avant-garde Jewish intellectual world of Berlin at that time. They knew one another reasonably well. Cassirer sent Einstein a draft of the book and got back from Einstein this letter, one of several, but nicely communicates Einstein's broad attitude, where he writes, I can understand your idealistic way of thinking about space and time, and I even believe that one can thus achieve a consistent point of view. To me as a non-philosopher, philosophical contrarieties appear more contrarieties of emphasis than of a principled kind. What Mach calls connections are for you ideal names, which experience first makes possible. But you emphasize this side of knowledge, whereas Mach wants to make them appear as insignificant as possible. I acknowledge that one must approach experience with some sort of conceptual functions in order for science to be possible, but I do not believe that we are placed under any constraint in the choice of these functions by virtue of the nature of our intellect. Conceptual systems appear empty to me if the manner in which they are to be referred to experience is not established. This appears most essential to me, even if to our advantage we often isolate in thought the purely conceptual relations in order to permit the logically secure connections to emerge more purely. So again, broad skepticism about the neo-Kantian project. And, as I mentioned a moment ago, the other great neo-Kantian of this period, not yet the logical empiricist we know him and love him for being in later years, is Hans Reichenbach, who in 1920 published his then very influential book on relativity theory and a priori knowledge, a book that, of course, has once again in our era become extremely influential because this is the philosophical source out of which Michael Friedman has been drawing for the past 15 years in his project to bring Kant back into the philosophy of science mainstream, as with his quite famous now Kant lectures. Why am I suddenly blanking on the title of the book? Anyway, neither here nor there. So let me back up and make a point about how Cassirer wanted to try to reconcile relativity theory and general relativity. Or excuse me, Kant and general relativity. So Cassirer's idea was this, that Kant was basically right about the ineluctable role of a priori elements in theory, but that Kant had just been a little bit too precise in his characterization of what that a priori was, and that the lesson of general relativity was that we needed to weaken the a priori to some weaker mathematical structure, weaker than a full-blown metrical geometry. And in a sense, what Cassirer is arguing is that we want to back off to some kind of a priori topological structure, is one way of characterizing the idea. Reichenbach has a very different way of trying to characterize, trying to argue how you can reconcile Kant and Einstein. And Reichenbach's way of doing this is as follows. He introduces this idea that today we call the contingent or the relativized a priori. Reichenbach argues that the Kantian notion of the a priori conflates two different notions that should be held apart. One is apodicticity or necessity, and the other is the constructive role of the a priori. And Reichenbach argues that the proper lesson of general relativity is that we have to let go of apodicticity in our conception of the a priori. We have to let go of necessity, but we will hold on to the constructive work that the a priori does. It's just that as science progresses, what plays that constructive role in science will change. And this, again, is very much the Friedman program of the last 20 years or so. A big debate breaks out in the early 1920s involving Schlick and Reichenbach, a whole bunch of other actors, over this book. So Schlick writes to Einstein, October 1920. I've just read the booklet by Reichenbach. The work really appears to me to be quite a splendid contribution to the axiomatics of the theory and physical knowledge in general. Of course, in a few points, I still cannot entirely support him. Reichenbach seems to me not to be fair with regard to the theory of conventions of Poincaré, what he calls a priori principles of coordination, and rightly distinguishes from the empirical principles of connection, seem to me to be wholly identical with Poincaré's conventions, and to have no significance beyond that. Ars reliance upon Kant seems to me to be carefully considered only purely terminological. Now, this is an extremely important letter because it's the earliest evidence known to me of the line of critical response to Reichenbach's book that is going to develop among the logical empiricist or the nascent logical empiricist community at this time, where the line is, yeah, this is all really interesting, this is all really good. There's just this one problem. You're calling these constructive elements a priori, and it would be fairer, it would be more helpful if you would term them conventions. And that's the birth moment of this idea of conventional coordinating definitions that becomes an absolutely essential piece of the right-wing logical empiricist mature story about the structure and empirical interpretation of scientific theory in the 20s and beyond. And here is Schlick making this point to Einstein. Here is Schlick making this point to Reichenbach. Just a short while later. Reichenbach for a while resists this suggestion, but eventually he concedes the point to Einstein, to Schlick, to everyone else who's making it. And by the time of his, I'm going to skip over this. By the time of his 1924 book on the axiomatics of relativity theory, he has wholly assimilated himself to the view that Schlick by this time is sort of promoting as orthodoxy in the right-wing logical empiricist community, which is, again, in a very shorthand capsule formulation, that, and it's very much in the tradition of Poincaré, not Duhem, I want to insist upon that point, that one must make a systematic principled distinction between analytic coordinating definitions through which empirical content flows into our theory concept by concept, hence proposition by proposition, and on the other hand, the empirical synthetic propositions that we constitute out of the individual concepts that get their empirical content via those analytic coordinating definitions. This really is the birth moment of modern 20s vintage, 30s vintage, and beyond logical empiricist philosophy of science. And it grows out of this argument among Einstein, Schlick, and Reichenbach, engendered by Reichenbach's book. Time is running short, so I'm going to skip over some more of the historical detail. There are interesting puzzles about the gradual shift in Schlick's own view away from a more Duhemian holist point of view in the teens to a more Poincaré, Reichenbach-like view, emphasizing the principal distinction between synthetic claims and analytic coordinating definitions. On the other hand, a view that's cemented by the time of the 22nd edition of his General Theory of Knowledge. Skip over that. And of course, it's all reasserted by Reichenbach in 27. Let's skip over all of that for the sake of time. We'll skip over that. Let me fast forward to this. In the interest of time. So, as that argument with Reichenbach is settling down, the argument with the neo-Kantians is starting to heat up again. Because there's another wave of books that appears at this time from a different set of actors. And Einstein is once again reading all of this stuff and reacting in great detail to many of these books and papers that are appearing at this time. So, for example, we have this letter from Einstein to Eberhard Schimmer in September of 1922. And I want you to pay attention to what Einstein's central critical point directed toward the neo-Kantians comes to be at this time. He says, that which you work out in your essay seems correct to me, at least from the physical side, which is all that I can judge with certainty. In my opinion, though, the important question of the opposition of relativity theory and Kantian philosophy has not emerged sharply enough. Are the spatial-temporal forms, which also ground a priori the relativity theory, only convenient tools of description to be appraised as conventions, or are they givens necessitated simply by the character of human thought and inalterable in detail? I myself occupy the former standpoint, represented also by Helmholtz and Poincaré, whereas it appears to me that Kant's standpoint was more the latter. Most important, oh, here's another review from yet another one of these guys, Josef Winternitz. It's a very interesting story of who Winternitz was and why Einstein was connected to Winternitz. It goes back to Prague and some years earlier. But far and away the most important book, at least as judged by the importance of the reaction it elicited from Einstein, was the book by Alfred Elsbach, Kant and Einstein, Untersuchungen über das Verhältnis der modernen Erkenntnistheorie zur Relativitätstheorie, Investigations on the Relationship between Modern Theory of Knowledge and Relativity Theory, 1924. Einstein published a review of this book, an extensive review of this book, a detailed review of this book, in the Deutsche Literaturzeitung, one of the principal review journals of the period. And this paragraph, there's a lot of other interesting content that, if time permitted, we had fun exploring, such as an amplification on some of the interesting argumentation of Einstein's own essay, Geometry and Experience, in 1921. This paragraph stands out as extremely important in my reading, because it brings together a bunch of threads. It brings together Einstein's own more Duhem-like empiricism, his theory holism, and so forth, with his ever-sharpening repudiation of a Kantian project. And he writes, this does not at first preclude one's holding, at least, the Kantian problematic, as, for example, Cassirer has done, or even to the opinion that this standpoint can be rigorously refuted by no development of natural science. For one will always be able to say that critical philosophers have until now erred in the establishment of the a priori elements. Remember, Poincaré said Kant was wrong in saying that a metrical geometry was a priori. Let's just take a topological structure. And one will always be able to establish a system of a priori elements that does not contradict a given physical system. Let me briefly indicate why I do not find this standpoint natural. A physical theory consists of the parts, elements A, B, C, D, that together constitute a logical whole, which correctly connects the pertinent experiments, sense experiences. Then it tends to be the case that the aggregate of fewer than all four elements, for example, A, B, D without C, no longer says anything about these experiences, and just as well A, B, C without D. One is then free to regard the aggregate of three of these elements, for example A, B, C, as a priori, and only D as empirically conditioned. But what remains unsatisfactory in this is always the arbitrariness in the choice of those elements that one designates as a priori, entirely apart from the fact that the theory could one day be replaced by another that replaces certain of these elements, or all four, by others. Now savor what's going on at this point. Here is Einstein deploying Duhemian theory holism, and more specifically, exactly the argument that Duhem had formulated against Poincaré's attempt to mark a difference in kind between coordinating definitions and synthetic empirical claims. Namely, yes, you can parse your theory that way, but it's perfectly arbitrary how you do that. Here's Einstein using exactly that same Duhemian argument, but now turning it against the Kantians. It's just that what's arbitrary in this version of the argument is your choice of the a priori as your opposed to your choice of the a priori or the analytic coordinating definitions. Well, we could go on and on. There's lots more that's happening in Einstein's engagement with major philosophers of this period. Very interesting is his late 20s interaction with Emile Meyerson, another figure who should be much better known. And by the way, Bernadette Bonson-Vincent is about to publish her brand new intellectual biography of Meyerson. Keep an eye out for that. It should be a very important book. I want to end with two final comments and then invite your questions. So, in 1949, Schilp published the Einstein volume of the Library of Living Philosophers. And remember, it starts with an intellectual autobiography by Einstein, an extremely important text, and a series of critical essays. And then, as with all of these Schilp volumes, it ends with a section of replies by the figure in question to the critical essays. Extremely interesting is the contribution by Reichenbach and Einstein's reply to Reichenbach. So, Reichenbach, in his essay, had mainly rehearsed once again, more than 25 years later, the view that had, by the mid-1920s, become logical empiricist orthodoxy. Theories have content only if to the fundamental empirical propositions of the theory you adjoin these analytic coordinating definitions through which the individual propositions acquire their empirical content. But, of course, that's a conventional choice, yada, 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 yada. So he lays out that picture again in his essay. It elicits from Einstein, and I do want to read this passage, this extraordinary reply. Extraordinary for literary reasons as well as philosophical ones. It's because Einstein puts the reply in the form of a dialogue between, at first, two characters named Reichenbach and Poincaré. And then after a while, Einstein says, wait a minute, my respect for Poincaré is so great that I can't continue in this vein. And so he retitles the antagonist Arbitrary Non-Positivist. Okay? But this arbitrary non-positivist is channeling Einstein here. That's the important point. And Einstein, the arbitrary non-positivist, at this point says the following. If under the stated circumstances you hold distance to be a legitimate concept, think infinitesimal metric interval, how then is it that with your basic principle, namely meaning equals verifiability, must you not come to the point where you deny the meaning of geometrical statements and concede meaning only to the completely developed theory of relativity, which still does not exist at all as a finished project? Must you not grant that no meaning whatsoever in your sense belongs to the individual concepts and statements of a physical theory, such meaning belonging instead to the whole system insofar as it makes intelligible what is given in experience? Why do the individual concepts that occur in a theory require any separate justification after all, if they are only indispensable only within the framework of the logical structure of the theory, and if it is the theory as a whole that stands the test? This is pure Duhem theory holism. But, very importantly and very explicitly, it is extended, as Duhem himself had extended, also to a thoroughgoing semantic holism, holism in the way concepts acquire their meaning. It bears comparison with Quine's two dogmas of empiricism, which appears almost immediately after the Schulte volume appears. This is exactly the same view that Quine very famously then defends over the next several decades. I was so struck by this that I wrote to Quine, and I said, any chance you may have seen this? And of course, Quine being the modest and humble individual that he was, and by the way, I'm a huge Quine fan, so don't take that wrongly, but he wrote back, I said, well, no, this is very, very interesting, but I'm sure I never saw this before I published Two Dogmas. Anyway, but again, here is Einstein at his Duhemian best, very near the end of his life. And it's a view that he stuck with until the very end. And let me end with a brief remark about Carnap, with whom there had been less extensive personal relations during the 20s, 30s, and beyond. There had been connections, of course. Carnap had spent a lot of his early life, in particular, writing a lot on philosophical problems having to do with space-time theory, starting with his doctoral dissertation under Bruno Bauch, and continuing for many, many years. I just want to end with this. In 1952, Carnap was visiting in Princeton, and Paul Oppenheim, who was a mutual friend of Carnap and Einstein, arranged for the two of them to sit down together for an afternoon just to have a chat. And Carnap recorded this conversation in his diary, which is very hard to read because it's in an ancient form of German shorthand that nobody can read anymore, but thankfully there is a transcription. One of the topics they came to talk about was this same nexus of issues, only more specifically, at this point, they talked about it in the form of the Neurath boat metaphor, which again, we all know from Quine as one of the famous ways of expressing the essential insight of Duhemian theory and semantic holism. It's the idea of, you know, empiricist foundationalism wants to rebuild the ship of theory in a dry dock on secure foundations. Duhem wants us to rebuild it. Neurath wants us to rebuild it one plank at a time while the ship is floating at sea. Carnap says, on reality, I say that only Mach advanced such formulations according to which the sense data are the only reality. reality. He, Einstein, says that the positivists nevertheless want to start from something securely given and that there is no such starting point. I agree. There is no rock bottom. Neurath's reconstruction of the ship afloat. With that, he emphatically agreed. In the German, it says, er stimmt energisch dazu, right? Which is very strong indeed. So here we have Einstein almost at the very end of his life, once again recording this strongly Duhemian point of view about interpretation of scientific theory. I've run out of time.